So today, our keynote speaker I want to introduce is Rick Spencer, and he's going to be talking a bit about why the project matters, why all this stuff matters with open source, why you're here, right? And so Rick is the general manager for Business Critical Linux for SUSE. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here. I really appreciate the invitation to come and meet everyone in the community. As you said, my name is Rick, and I am the general manager of Business Critical Linux at SUSE. I've been there since January 2nd, but we'll spend some time discussing how it all happened. How did I end up here? But if you're wondering what that means basically I'm the boss of the division in SUSE that makes Linux. And I love it. I super have been enjoying being here. So I have some slides. So first, just when I talk about this slide, we're talking like, why does this matter? Why does this project matter? Like, what's going on here? And I put up this elaborate graphic, not AI generated, by the way, just to show, like, really, I'm going to talk about it from a pretty personal perspective of working at SUSE, someone who is very new to the SUSE community, but someone who's not new to the open source community and working in open source, and who has a perspective about SUSE from the outside for a long time. Does that sound good? Okay. So first, what's going on here? Before I started, I asked my boss, Thomas, what should I be running on my laptop? And he said I should run Leap, which I still do. Same laptop. That's a screenshot from this laptop. This is from back in December, from before I officially started. And this, like when I set up a new machine for a desktop, this sort of represents to me that I have control of the system. I don't do a lot on social media, like I don't use Twitter or Facebook or anything like that, but I have a omg.lol account where I blog, and that gives me access to Mastodon and such. See there where it says Rick Spencer 3? That's like my handle everywhere that I have a presence. So if you want to look me up on GitHub or Mastodon or I don't know, wherever, like going back to about 2008, you'll find me under that tag. But yeah, I was actually a little taken aback by how good Leap was. Like when I installed it, I was expecting a difficult time to install, and I was expecting a difficult time to get set up for productivity, and like none of those things happened. I wrote some blog posts about it over time. If you want to go back and see those. So I've been a super happy user of OpenSUSE since even before I started. Okay, so how did I end up here? Like here we are, 2024. I'm in the OpenSUSE community. I'm working at SUSE. And just in terms of my perspective, I thought it would be helpful just to like give like, you know, maybe a older guy than some of you folks a perspective on just how weird the world can be that you end up in situations like this. So I started out in 1990 as a young philosophy graduate. So I studied philosophy in college, and I was in the U.S., so of course we studied continental philosophy in the U.S., right? I don't know if you know, but like in the U.S. you study continental philosophy, which is European, and in Europe you study philosophy from America for some reason. So, but I also had a degree in psychology, and I went to a college that focused on preparing people for a life of service. right? So some people go to colleges where it's like they want to make lawyers and politicians and stuff like that. If you wanted to be really cool at my college, you would go be a teacher or a social worker or something like that, and that like really represented that you are ready for, you know, a life of real service to the community. So I actually went into community mental health, and so I started out as a, you know, young man working with people with very severe mental illnesses who, you know, we're trying to keep in the community, keep them from being homeless, keep them out of the hospital, that kind of thing. And it was really rewarding intrinsically, but not so much extrinsically. It's not the field that you go into to support a family, for instance. And so our first baby came, I got married, and then we had a baby, and I thought, you know, maybe I should start thinking about computers again. And so I went to George Mason University, and I got a degree in human factors engineering, which is a field of cognitive psychology where you learn about how to design software for the human mind. And since I had a background as a programmer, I focused on what was called the psychology of programming. And if you want to geek out about that, I'd like love to talk about it. It's super interesting. But that made me end up getting recruited by Microsoft. So in 1998, I picked my family up and moved from the East Coast to the West Coast, to Seattle, in fact, which began a 15-year stint living in Seattle. And I worked at Microsoft for quite a long time. And I started there in Visual Studio and designing the debugger and the editor. And I spent a lot of focus on the .NET language, C#. That was really interesting because they were like, we need some kind of open source strategy, even though we're pretty hostile to open source. So they had this thing called Mono, and there was like C# had like an open specification, and there was like an open source implementation of that as part of Mono and all this stuff. And while I was there, my philosophy degree was a raging advantage because I could write. And so I would go to meetings and come out and summarize the meetings and bludgeon people with my writing. And that led to me going up through the program management ranks. And that was basically being sort of the spiritual leader of teams, of development teams. And by the time I left, I was working in Windows, and I was running the team that made the SDK for tablets. But something happened on the way, which was that I got very interested in open source and started contributing to open source. And this was, it's hilarious, because now, of course, Microsoft is, you know, very open to other perspectives. But at the time, they were not. And so I ended up having to leave Microsoft to pursue a career in open source. It got so bad that my boss came to my office, and like the poor guy, I could tell someone made him come talk to me because they realized the reason that my emails were in text was because I was using Outlook web access at home instead of Outlook, and that was because I was running Linux on my laptops at home. And they were like, oh, we think you're running Linux at home, and it's not a rule that you can't do that, but they you know, they were a little offended by that. And so I could see the writing was on the wall. I quit Microsoft with actually out of plan. I was just like, I'm burned out. I'm going to go work in open source. And it was like, you're crazy. Like, you have this great job at Microsoft. What the heck? What are you doing? And but in fact, I spent a few months writing some code, and then I got recruited by a local family business, which was a big real estate agency, and they had a new website that they were having trouble getting out. And so I spent a year helping them with that. And then in the meantime, I saw a posting for Ubuntu, and I'd started contributing to the Ubuntu community in different ways, mostly writing about how to program, how to be a programmer targeting it. And by that, I mean a Python programmer, to be very specific. So I applied for a job as the Ubuntu engineering manager for the desktop. And you have to understand, at the time, it was like a very exciting project. And you know, it was controversial because, like, you know, people in Debian were upset and this kind of thing. But it was like people were super excited about the opportunity to spread software freedom. You know, we saw people who were using Windows as sort of almost being enslaved in a way, right? Because they, you know, they didn't like the level of lock-in that they were experiencing and such, and that they didn't see another way. And so we were just really excited about this opportunity to create software freedom for people who didn't have like the technical skills themselves to like opt into software freedom themselves. Those were like really great days, especially at the beginning when I thought we were going to succeed. And I thought, you know, like, oh, and we're going to have a phone OS. And we, you know, we just had a lot of fun times. Unfortunately, I got promoted a few times and I ended up like running the project and all this stuff. So it was like, you know, it became a lot of responsibility. And then I ended up leaving in 2017, and I joined a company called Bitnami. And our mission was to package all of the open source cloud software in the world and make it available. And we packaged everything. And our customers were the cloud providers. Our users were like all of you. And we ended up getting acquired. Turned out not to be a really good match for me in the acquiring organization when I told them, like, I will only work at home, I will only manage remote teams, I will only work on open source. And they were like, okay, would you consider a severance package? And so I took that and I went and I joined some friends at InfluxDB. And there we made an open source time series database, and this guy named Paul Dix, he's a super cool guy, like he's the founder of the company. And so I worked there for about 4 years and really loved it. I was like on the very senior executive team there, which was, you know, just like at Ubuntu, very interesting, like actually all the three of those places, it's like really interesting when you're like looking every day at like what's our runway. You know, if we spend this money, will, like, how long will we be able to survive? And, you know, if we spend this money, will we make enough money to extend or the runway and all that kind of businessy management stuff? I, of course, am way more passionate about the technology and the users and the community. But I really liked working at Influx Data. And then last September, you know, one of the things I love about working remotely is that every now and then we're like, let's just go try a different place. So last September, my wife and I went and we tried Crete, and we were living in this city on Crete called, depending on how you pronounce it, we called it Hana, but some people call it Chania. The people there, I can't pronounce it the way they pronounce it. But so we were sitting there, I was working, and I got a call from Susa, this guy named John, and he's like, hey, I'm an executive recruiter at SUSE. We're looking for somebody to run the SUSE Linux division. And I was like, wow, I never thought I'd get the opportunity again to work on a distro, like a community open source distro. Like, this is what I live for, right? And I just thought it was just over for me. I'd never have that opportunity again. Of course, I didn't tell the recruiter, but I immediately went into like, what can I do to get this job mode? And, you know, I talked to some people like Jeff here and other people as part of the recruiting process. And super delighted that I got the job, very honored. And I started on January 2nd officially. So I am a super newbie. So please keep that in mind as we see the content that I'm presenting today, because really, I feel like I'm just being introduced to the community now. Okay, so just backing up a bit, has anyone here ever had a call with me? Okay, quite a few people. So you recognize this is the background. This is my real background. This is not AI generated. This is my man cave here. Let me just explain a few things, because I think it helps people kind of get where I'm coming from. So this box here, these are all like the tools that I use for different electronics projects. And I used to do this a lot more than I do now. I've just built everything I wanted to. I have a longer version of this talk where it shows like a million little projects that I made. But I don't know about you. Does anybody else have a box like this? I have like three of them, yeah. It's full of Raspberry Pis and Arduinos. This cardboard box. At the beginning of the pandemic, I made this thing where you could hold your hand over it and it would take your temperature and then print out the temperature. And I was thinking, like, put it in front of stores so people could show that they didn't have a fever when they went in. But then I couldn't source the temperature sensors. Like, they just, China ran out of those in one day. So I have like three of those boxes. A while ago, I was into 3D printing. I still do it, and like when I got the job, I printed. I found online these SUSE keychains. So somebody in the community put these up. Was that somebody here? Oh no, I'm disappointed. But the one thing I love about 3D printing is that people take all their models and they open source them, and they just release them and with. Licenses that you can take them and remix them and share your remixes back and everything. I use these for luggage tags now, so I can tell my luggage when it comes out. This is a robot that I built. So what happened here was I went to this very small IoT conference, and it was there was a guy there named Nathan from a company called SparkFun. And he gifted me something called the SparkFun Inventors Kit. I hadn't really been that interested in electronics and things like that before, but the SparkFun Inventors Kit came with an Arduino. So like what's amazing about this is like Arduino is open hardware. So they like, of course, they sell their own Arduinos and specify them, but they release in a way that a company like SparkFun can take and improve upon those designs and share them in different ways. So they created an Arduino that was for people like me who are learning, and they put it into a kit that had a breadboard and jumper cables and all these sensors and all this stuff, and then instructions for how to learn everything. And it just like sucked me up into this community of people who are doing like really fun things with our Arduinos. And you know, of course, they all shared their source code and everything. I shared mine back. But then I decided, for some reason, I had to make a robot. I don't know why. I just had to make a robot. So I bought a chassis from Amazon. And you can see there's the Raspberry Pi that powers it. And my wife, Ilsebe, and my daughter, Sophie, were away traveling. And while they were away, I had finally gotten control of the LCD screen there, and so I sent them a little message. The reason you needed the LCD screen was because the way you controlled the robot was, if he wasn't connected to the network, he would tell you the IP address or the access point, and like you would connect to it with your phone and then put in the access point information, and then you would reach him over the local network, and there's a little UI to drive him around. That, by the way, all my source code's called Rickbot. All the source code for him is up on GitHub. But I looked at it like a year ago, and it was embarrassingly bad. So this is the thing I got from SparkFun, and this is me prototyping something called Plant Buddy. So when I got to Influx Data, I made this device called Plant Buddy, which measures the soil temperature, soil moisture level, the humidity, the air temperature, and the light level, and puts all that data into Influx Data, all those metrics, which is what Influx Data is for, a time series database. I was like really proud of that because that got kind of sucked up into the community as like the reference application, because I wrote like code for doing alerting and graphing and all this stuff, and that sort of became the reference application for the community. Of course, my friend Jay just completely improved all the code, so you wouldn't recognize it as mine now because it's much better. But okay, so a lot of times people ask me about these posters. So these are from a band called The Grateful Dead. Has anybody in here heard of this ancient band? A couple people. So I started going to Grateful Dead concerts in 1984. And I still go, and I get posters from their shows, and I hang them up behind me in different configurations. But one thing that's really interesting is, first of all, people who are fans of the music are really feel like they're in a community, right? And like you run into people who are fans. It's just like open source developers, right? It's like you meet someone and they're a Grateful Dead fan or an open source developer, like you immediately have an affinity with them, and you know, you end up like halfway to being friends. They were sort of, for me, my first exposure to open source, because what they did was they let people tape their shows and share the tapes as long as they were like in non-commercial usage, right? As long as you weren't competing with their albums. And so like their way of being heard was not on the radio, which made sense because their songs could be like 40 minutes long, but through people like sharing and trading tapes. So you can still go up to archive.org, and there's like thousands of hours of their music up there, and it's all completely, completely free in both meanings of the word. And I do play music. I don't play the guitar so much anymore. I honestly don't play the mandolin that much anymore, but when I play the mandolin. Does anyone else in here play anything? A few folks, all right. So, here's another like sort of aspect of like community and open source and sharing. Like most of the music that I play, I like to say I play all the hits of the 90s, but the 1890s. So like all this music is in the public domain already. And the way that you learn it is like other people show you and sharing it, and you get together and you jam. And the music I like is like specifically fiddle tunes, which, to not geek out too much, it's like there's these eighth notes, but with a really, really strong swing to it. And the idea is like you take like a pass through the tune and improvise over it while your friends back you up, and then someone else takes a turn. And it's really fun to play, probably more fun to play than it is to listen to. But all this music is all shared. It's all free. It's very in the moment. And there's like just a big community of people around still playing this kind of music together. And then this is the last thing on my desktop. That's my $65 laptop. You can go read all about it on my blog. I got it at Micro Center, which is this like super discount place in the US. It's running Tumbleweed right now. I was really excited because when I installed Tumbleweed, the network kept, the Wi-Fi module kept just like disconnecting, or it wasn't even disconnecting, it would just stop getting data, stop reporting data. And I was like, yes, my first bug report. I'm gonna like write a bug report, and I'm gonna learn how to be like a contributor to OpenSUSE, because you know, I'll work with the kernel developers to get them the information that they need to debug it. And I got my Bugzilla account, and it's never reproduced since then. Okay. Yes, I guess somebody fixed it on the way. All right, so what's this? This is my part of my childhood. So I started as a programmer on a TSR-80. My school got a bunch of these, and there's just like a community of us who would hang around after school. And the only thing you could do with them was program, really. Like, that's what the computers were for. They were for programming. Like, there was like, you know, I guess there was software that was distributed in some ways, but what's over here was called a listing, and this is how we shared software. Like in the back of magazines, or there'd be whole books of them, there'd just be basic programs written out. And I know some people who were way smarter than me were doing like assembly and stuff, but we all just learned basic programming. And so it was weird. I learned how to program at like, you know, I was like 12 years old, and I never like valued it as a skill, just because I just picked it up when I was a kid. And so, and we all shared our code. I remember I had this great guy named Jack Harrington, who was like way smarter than me, and would he'd be in the computer room after school, and he would always help me with whatever question I have. I have a very explicit memory of him explaining that like I needed to define a variable to track state in a game that I was writing. And I just like, I talked to him recently and he doesn't remember this at all, but I have a very explicit memory of him teaching me this. What's interesting is he's like big in the React community, I think, but he's still like, he's a professional programmer, but he also has a YouTube channel where he teaches still. Like to this day, he's still like this source of wisdom and knowledge. So that's kind of how I got into open source, really, and just like always just thought of source code as being open from the beginning. So fast forwarding a little bit, here's an example of some project that I worked on before I joined Canonical. This sort of got me in my foot in the door when I was talking to Canonical about the Ubuntu job. I wrote a Ruby on Rails application. And then I started, I took up swimming. And so I would be swimming, and I'm a very slow swimmer, which gave me a lot of time to think. And over the course of like 2 weeks of swimming, I designed in my mind like a development environment for the Ubuntu desktop. And I forget what I called it at first, but it was very Rails-like, right? So there were commands that would create a template. I was like, you should just use Glade, just use Python, just use gedit. And so it was like, you know, at the time, if you wanted to learn how to write a desktop application, they were like, sure, here's literally 50 options to choose from, right? And it's like, you know, do you want Qt and C, Qt with Python? Do you want like GDK? Do you want like how, like, or maybe you want Tinker, like there's like so many options. I say, you know, I really think the community would benefit from somebody just defining one way from beginning to end. And so I wrote a book, and which I sadly lost, but I had like 6 chapters of like how to write an application. And then my friend Didier Roach, like after I joined Canonical and started showing people there, he was just like appalled by the code, so he rewrote it all, which is frankly how all the best projects I've ever had have gone, is like, you know, I put out code out there that was useful, and then some good programmer objects to its quality and then rewrites it for me in one night. Diddy and I were friends, we're still friends, we were friends for years. We used to exchange houses and stuff like that. He's got little kids now, so I don't talk to him as much. So I've written a lot of these kind of application frameworks to sort of help people get going with different aspects of open source. Another thing that I do a lot is I call it writing to learn. And so you'll see a lot of like these I consider like the best contributions I personally am able to make, just like given my skills. So just quickly here, like back in 2011, after I wrote so many applications that I knew how to write undo and redo stacks in 2 ways. So it was like just once and for all, explain for everybody who's a Python programmer how to do undo and redo. And then over here, remember that robot that I showed? Part of it was like you had to control the amount of power that goes to the wheels. And from the battery into the motors. And, you know, you wanted, there's like 255 levels of energy that you could let flow. So you used an L29 3D chip, and it took me quite a long time to figure out how to use it. So I wrote this and put it up on GitHub so other people could get a fast track to learning. It's funny because I actually, every time I need to use one, I end up referring to this myself. So that's writing to learn. I think that's like a really nice contribution that people can make. Okay, so now so now you kind of see like, you know, just the way like I view the world. Now let's talk, like I'd like to just talk a little bit about the way I view SUSE and OpenSUSE and all these projects around it. I'd like to caveat this with like, I understand that I'm very new to the community and these are not super well-formed thoughts. So, I invite people to help me learn. But let's go. So first of all, 30 years, 20 years. This is not like a flash in the pan project. Do these numbers mean anything to anybody? 30 years ago was the first project called with the name SUSE in it, and 20 years ago was the first project with the name OpenSUSE in it. Right? Like, these things are here to stay. These are not like flimsy, flashy memes, right? This is a real project. Like, think of how many people have benefited from these projects over the years, either as contributor or user. This is a significant, meaty project. This is a foundation of the open source community, right? Does that make sense? Okay. So what's going on here? This is strip mining, and I don't want to call out any specific projects or companies or anything, but I think we can all see that there's certain areas where people moved into a more of a short-term mode of thinking, right? Typically what I've seen is like a company will get acquired by a bigger company, and that acquirer will look at the user base and say, hey, you know what, like, those users are kind of locked in. We could probably like raise prices a lot and they'd have nowhere to go. And if they do go somewhere, it would take them a couple years. In the meantime, we could probably recoup everything that we used to buy that company with, right? So I call this strip mining. Whether you're strip mining the community, strip mining the user base, I'm really proud to work at SUSE because I just do not see us doing this. Like, the community and the company's value system is really antithetical to this kind of concept, right? So if let me talk a little bit of what I mean by that, really specifically from the community point of view. So let's say you want a base image. Do we lock you into the right base image that puts you into our marketing funnel so that that base image then turns into like, okay, we reach out to you, and then like, you know, do we withdraw base images from the community so that, you know, we send people down the path that we want them? No, that is just like not in the SUSE mindset, right? So the Open SUSE community lets you say, hey, you can choose between a rolling or a stable release depending on your needs. And you can choose between a traditional and an immutable OS depending on your needs. And in fact, there's other projects that have built on this. Like, I know I put micro OS here, but I know that Aeon, I think, is built on micro OS, for example. There's probably other things that are built on it as well. So I know this is an oversimplification, but I think this is really cool that we celebrate fulfilling our needs as contributors, but also, you know, the needs of users who are picking this stuff up. And it goes a little deeper. This was not made by AI either. This is a drawing, again, an oversimplification that I did for one of my blog posts. And this is just meant to help people understand the relationship of open build server, internal build server. But the main thing I want to show is the packagers here. And this is like one of the things that I love about OpenSUSE is that the project has like so many options for me, right? So I can choose the base image that I want. And then because we're like different community members are pulling from different upstreams, then I can assemble the stack on top of that, which makes sense to me personally. And even if it's not like in Zipper, I can find an OBS, maybe somebody's made a version that works for me, and there's other repositories and et cetera. So this notion of choice is very powerful for me. But then also because you can see everything in Open Build Service, like all the source code's there as well, right? So like, it's not just choice. Like, you know, you get choice at a restaurant, but you get freedom also, right? Because like, all you can go back to the source code and do what you need for that. Even though somebody like me might not have the skills to take advantage of that, at least I benefit indirectly from it. And then finally, the last thing I want to talk about then is like opportunity, right? Like as a user, the fact, like, okay, Tumbleweed may not be the most cutting edge rolling release, right? There may be some that are twitchier and like, you know, packages are available within hours of the main upstream. But like Tumbleweed is remarkably stable, right? And so even Tumbleweed is something that you can really build something important out of. And so these OpenSUSE projects that we put out there create really important opportunities for people, whether it's to fulfill a personal need, whether it's a professional need, or even just like a basic life need, right? Like I would trust this project to like power a, you know, computer controlled water pump for my village, right? So, and our focus on quality, I think, and just like thinking about the people consuming the software and making sure they're having that good experience, I think is a big part of that. All right, so I'll finish up in time. I might have time for a few questions. So again, this part is a little vague, but it's just like to communicate like why I'm here and why I'm in it for the long haul. And the first is the community, right? If you look back, what is community? Some people define it as your community is like those people that you see recurring in different settings, right? And whether it's people that you're working with in Bugzilla, or you're on planning calls with them, or they're doing code reviews for you, etc. And also just hanging out and coming and getting together in spaces like this, and like I live for this, like being like part of these communities around these like interests. But you know, like the music is fun; those are fun communities. But this software that we're making is very meaningful. So this is like a meaningful community built around a meaningful project. And then the second is freedom. Freedom means different things to other people. But you know, when I look at the way SUSE, the company, behaves and the communities around it, I think this is like just a non-negotiable aspect of most, you know, the things that we do. I feel that if somebody had any need that they wish to fulfill with the software that this community produces, like they'd be able to. There's like no prior constraints on that. And then the last bit there is opportunity. And this is, I'm not sure how many people think about this, but I think about this a lot. Like a good open source project like this creates real opportunity for other people, like real economic opportunity, right? Like you're starting a business, you know, you could be anywhere in the world, maybe somewhere that's like not well-funded. Maybe you don't have a cutting-edge RISC-V server, and like that's not your issue. Your issue is that you're starting with like leftover hardware. Well, guess what? We're there to support you. We have the software. You can get an image. And also, if you ask questions, if you need help, like we're right there to help you. And this is really, I think, an important aspect of communities like OpenSUSE. I also think it provides opportunities to contribute and collaborate, which is just a necessary part of the human condition. And so just having the community there and creating those opportunities for people to hop in and contribute artwork or contribute bug reports, contribute documentation, like all these kinds of like these opportunities, like I think are super meaningful. So my last slide, this one is AI generated, by the way. This is just to remind me to express my gratitude. Like, I was like really happy when they invited me to come and talk at the OpenSUSE conference, since I'm like really new to the community. I don't feel like I've made any like really substantial contribution yet, although, you know, I hope next year that I'm here talking about maybe some of the impact that as a community member, as any community member, like I've been able to have on the project. Okay, I think we have 5 minutes for questions. Okay. If there are any questions. Yeah. I can't tell if he has the question or is going to the bathroom. Okay.
Thank you. Not a question, but you were talking about a keychain for the 3D printing. We have a little
Lego. Oh, yeah, I know what you mean. Okay, yeah.
We have a little Lego Kabelion for 3D printing, which is on GitHub now, so if you are interested in, you know, OpenSUSE branded stuff, it's not exactly OpenSUSE, but it's close enough.
Okay.
So that could be your next project. We could use some improved STLs. It's really difficult to print.
Okay.
Oh. You have it on Slack already.
Did you have a question, sir? Here, do you just want to come use this mic? Okay. He wants to be far away from me when he asks. I'll,
You were pretty careful about asking about, or stating that you come from a philosophy background. And I wondered how you felt like that had helped you beyond just writing.
So he's asking, how did my philosophy background help me beyond just writing? So first of all, when anyone makes fun of anyone for getting a philosophy degree, when they're like, what are you going to go do work in the philosophy factory or whatever? I say, you don't understand. Like, if you have a philosophy degree, you can do whatever you want, because what you have done is you have learned how to learn. Whatever you learn today is not going to be particularly relevant 5 years from now. So if you have mastered the art of hierarchical thinking and being able to break down concepts and learn, then I encourage all people to go into philosophy, and actually liberal arts in general, for that reason. Obviously, I'm partial to philosophy, but I have the same views of like history and other things. So did that answer your question? It also taught me a lot about ethics, but we can talk about that over beer. Okay. Yep, another question?
The TRS-80 Model 1 that you showed, is that an actual functioning machine?
Oh, I don't know. I got that from the internet, but I assume so. I watch a lot of YouTube videos of people reconditioning old machines like that, so I know there's quite a few out there. But I still remember, like, the commands to get it going, and I still remember that. My next computer was a Commodore 64. But I didn't really program that one too much. I was just more like pirating and playing games and such. But I programmed it a little. Why did you react that way? Did you program a Commodore 64? Okay.
I didn't understand
anyone about it. There you go. Yeah, we were all kids at one time. Okay. Just once again, I really thank everyone for the welcome here. I want you to know I'm Rick Spencer 3, like everywhere. Reach out. Meet me if, you know, we're hanging around if you have any other questions. And I hope you enjoy the rest of the conference. Thank you.